Thank you. My name's Andrew and I'm an alcoholic. Before we go on, I'd just like to let everyone know that we are recording the convention this weekend. And if you'd want to buy any CDs at the back there, where Pat is superbly manning the literature stall, just put your name down and we'll get a copy of those in the post to you. It is now time to introduce our second speaker this evening, Alicia N.
Hi, I'm Alicia. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the committee and everyone who put this together and got us over here. It's been an amazing experience so far. You have an absolutely beautiful city, incredible country, and thank y'all so much for all the hard work you've done to make it possible. This is my second adventure traveling with Chris and Myers, and I think I've decided I'm going to write a book about life with Chris and Myers. If I could write down some of the little things they say just out of the blue, it's been a trip, but as always, enjoy you guys. the theme for this conference, the primary purpose, what an amazing deal to come across country to be able to do that. And, you know, I'm blessed in our little town of Kerrville, Texas, where I'm from, and blessed to carry the message there in a bunch of different ways, and just an incredible honor to get to come across the country to carry the message. We were talking outside, some of us, and, you know, the book says this disease is no respecter of persons. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, or what you've been through. If you've got it, you've got it, you know, and the story that was shared earlier, I forgot his name, I'm sorry, but he told my story, just the exact same kind of stuff that I've been through, and here we are across the nation, across the country, and same deal, same solution, you know, and that's what we're here to talk about this weekend. I wish I had a more exciting way to start my story, but I am going to just kind of let you know what got me into Alcoholics Anonymous a few years ago, and then what this program has done for me and where it's gotten me today. I'm from San Antonio. It's a bigger city, but not too far from Kerrville, and come from a great home, wonderful family, you know, no real reason that, you know, that people seem to think that terrible things happen and that's why you start drinking, and we know that that's not the case at all, because in my experience, I came from a wonderful home. I went to private school for 10 years. My father is a pastor and now a missionary. I have a wonderful mother with four brothers and sisters and just a wonderful life. And at about 14, though, I really started to recognize, looking back, I can recognize it, the symptoms of the spiritual malady, you know, just the anxiety, the depression, the fear, just the uncomfortableness. And at 14, found alcohol. And I remember consciously thinking that I was going to be doing this for a long time, because when you added alcohol to my system, all the voices went away. All that darkness went away. All the fears went away. And I was funnier. I was prettier. I could dance better. I wasn't scared to talk to the guys or the girls anymore. And it just made me feel right. And thus began my journey down alcoholism road, if you want to call it. And by 17... that road took me. It had progressed already fairly quickly. And at 17, I had transferred to public school after being in private school for 10 years. And I immediately gravitated to the drinking and drugging crowd, you know, because they're much more exciting. And the head of this group had broken up with me. I was dating him for a little while, and he broke up with me, and I was devastated, you know, because we were going to be together forever. It was high school, you know, junior in high school. And so I set out that night to get lit. You know, the book says we like to blot out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we know how. And the best way I knew to do it was to get lit. And so I did. And I remember going out that night. I remember getting dressed and looking in the mirror and walking out the door. And the next thing I remember, I wake up in a hospital and I have my jaws wired shut, my arms tied down, both legs in a cast, staples down my stomach, a feeding tube, and a trach coming out of my neck. And I had no idea what happened. And I'm told that I succeeded on my goal that night of getting lit, and my friends ended up having to bring me home because I was just, they couldn't handle me anymore. And my mother was there, and I was out of control, and she tried to stop me because I said I just wanted to leave, and she couldn't. And I got in the car and drove down the road, and I hit a telephone pole right down the street going about 45 miles an hour. And, the book says, given sufficient reason, can you quit drinking? You know, and by 17, I had my first big one. I almost died, you know, and I think had I been normal, I probably would have said alcohol bad and not touched it again. But that's not what I did at all. After being in the hospital for 3 months, learning how to walk again, et cetera, I my friends threw me a party when I got out of the hospital. You might have friends like that. they threw me a party, and not only am I drinking at this party, but I'm doing party tricks. You see, in my wreck, I bit the steering wheel like this, with my mouth, and I broke the palate of my mouth and knocked out 4 teeth, which last year when I spoke in Denmark, I was able to pop my teeth out for visual effect. Yeah, sorry, you're going to miss it. Because in this last year, God worked it out to where I could get my teeth fixed. But I did bring my teeth. They're in my purse. If anyone wants... I'm just kidding. Anyway, so at this party, I'm missing 4 teeth at this party, and I'm doing party tricks. I'm squirting beer where the teeth are missing. You know, I'm putting magnets on my face to attach to the metal clamp that's been inserted in my jaw. My trach hole wasn't even closed yet. Y'all are sick. You're laughing at this. My trach hole wasn't even closed yet. You know, I've got gauze over it, and I'm kind of pushing on it so I can talk. And at that time, this seems normal to me. Again, the book says your alcoholic life seems the only normal one, and that seemed normal. And that was the beginning of the insanity that was going to become my life. And I managed to make it through high school and went to college and one of the big schools in Texas that's kind of known as a party school. And they even had to change their name this last couple of years because everyone associated it with drinking. And so in my senior year, I took the SAT while on acid, which wasn't a very good idea because the dots were moving everywhere and everything. So I didn't score very high, but I scored high enough to get into this party school. So I thought I'd really done well, but I get to this school and this is when I really began to see that I don't drink like other people do. I got involved with a large group of women over there in this little sorority deal, and I'm starting to watch the way these women drink and what they do when they go out, and I'm strangely different. Something is different with me. I mean, we'd be getting ready to go out, and they'd be downstairs eating dinner before we went out. Exactly. Why? Why in God's name would you eat before you went out? You know, I'm upstairs drinking beer, you know, taking shots just to get right to walk out the door, you know, and night after night I would have these great plans. Okay, I'm just going to drink beer. I'll stay away from the hard liquor. Or I'm just going to, you know, do this or that. And I would have my little plans of how I was going to control it because I really didn't like who I became when I got so drunk. So I would try to make a plan as to keep that from happening. And it didn't work. And the crazy thing is, I mean, it was constant. Drinking was just constant in college. And the book says, paraphrasing here, but that we are highly intelligent in a lot of different areas, except for the effect alcohol has on us. And that was my experience. I was on the dean's list in college. When I did show up for class, you know, I did very well. But with this deal with alcohol, I could not seem to make the right choice and couldn't understand why at that time. I know now it's because I didn't have a choice. I'd lost that power to choose what I was going to do and when I was going to do it. But at the time, I just thought I had bad willpower, you know, that I was a bad girl, that I was weak, you know, and yet would go out and do it again, you know. So after 2 years of this experiment at school, I finally dropped out because apparently they want you to show up for class a lot, and I just too much pressure, so I couldn't. And at this time, I moved back home, and I met my first ex-husband. Well, I guess he was my first husband. He's my, never mind. anyway, the first guy I married, let's put it that way. And I have to tell this part of the story just because it's the women seem to relate to it. He had just gotten out of prison for 5 years straight, alcohol and drug charges. He was a drug dealer. I knew he abused women because I'd grown up around him and I knew his past. He had two children he didn't take care of. He had no job, no car, no money, and he was all mine. See, and I joke that some of you women in the room would have fought me for him. You know, and the book says we make decisions based on self that place us in a position to be hurt. And at that time of my life, I can see now that that's what I did, because I was going to change him. You know, my Wayward Souls program, bless God, was going to turn him around, and everyone would see what I had done with him. He was a drug dealer. I also like drugs. It was cool to hang out. I mean, I made all these decisions based on self that 5 years later, I had a knife to my wrist because I couldn't get away from the monster I was then married to, you know. But that began a very dark time in my life, and alcohol was a constant, and the consequences began, and there were drugs involved as well. And in 98, I'd lost everything, and the relationships with my family were gone. You know, the lies that I had told over and over again to try to keep my game going, you know, they were done. They were burnt, and they were tired of getting hurt by me. You know, I was absolutely the tornado that had run through their lives, and the debris that I kept leaving behind was they didn't want to be a part of it anymore. So at 25, as I said, I have a knife to my wrist because I can't quit drinking. I can't quit doing drugs, and I cannot get away from the monster I'm married to, and I don't know any way out. You know, and I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous from my stepfather. He had been involved in the program while I was drinking, and he used to always talk to me about this special place that he went and this special this, and he used to talk about his special friend, which was his sponsor. And many a beer did I throw on him when he mentioned his special program, you know, because it was like I didn't want to hear about it, you know, at that time. So I thought just ending it was the only way that this insanity was going to stop, because I cannot tell you how many times I would look in the mirror and just look at this soulless woman and just go, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. You know, I joke that I think blackouts are a gift from God, so I don't exactly have to know exactly what needs to stop, you know, so I don't have to go through all that pain each morning. But sometimes I absolutely did remember, and I remembered a lot of it, you know. And yet, just like the book says, that didn't keep me from doing it again. You know, strong resolution, hours later, drinking again, and this went on, and I didn't know how to stop it. So by the grace of God, I ended up in treatment in 98. And, God, I find out now that I had no desire to quit drinking. You know, I went there just to get the heat off. I went to get some food, to get some consistency, at least for 30 days going in my life. Cause I get there and I'm probably, you know, 20, 30 pounds thinner than I am now. I mean, just life hadn't been eaten, just not doing well. And, hair falling out, sunken in eyes, bruised. I was looking good. And my roommate was this rather large older woman, my roommate in detox, rather large older woman who was coming off of years of pills, of benzos and opiates, all kinds of things. And her head was about this big, and she had a perm that made her look a lot bigger. And all she could do is lay in this bed and hold up her sheet and go, that's all she could do. And I'm sitting there staring at this woman, and, you know, just hours before, I was at the club dancing. I was cool, and now look where I am. And I was like, how did I get here? And the book talks about that we are driven by fear and self-delusion. And at that time in my life, it was just eating me alive. And I'm in such self-delusion at this place. You know, I'm thinking, okay, I'm not as bad as these guys. No. Okay, a couple nights ago, okay, the whole knife thing. But besides that, I'm really okay, and I'm believing my story. And my parents dropped me off there with no clothes. They just took me. When I said I wanted help, they just took me. And so I borrowed, this lady gave me a nightgown of hers to wear. And I'm emaciatedly thin, but she was a larger woman. And so it was a nightgown that was Christmas flannel plaid. It was very sexy. And it had eyelet lace, turtleneck, and around here. And so I don't have any clothes. So she gives me this nightgown, and I put it on. And I got these skunk slippers from my mother's trunk, I think, right before she dropped me off. And they're big old skunk ears. And the knees, the ears came up to about my knees. And so I have no makeup, no clothes. I'm dressed in my gown and my slippers, and I'm on my detox meds. And and I am in such self-delusion that I got it going on, that I'm walking down the halls thinking I look hot, you know, just stumbling around the halls looking for a date, for God's sakes. And because, see, I found you can use many things to treat this spiritual malady. And for me, relationships and men, it's right up there on the top of the list. And so I figured, okay, I've got a 30-day vacation from Satan, which is what I used to call my ex-husband. That's not very nice. His name was Kirsten. Anyway, I have a 30-day vacation from him, so let's find someone else, you know. So dressed in my gown and my slippers, I found someone. Poor 19-year-old kid. I took him hostage. It was love me, you know. And I spent my whole 30 days wondering where he was, where he was going, what we were doing, blah, blah, blah. And I was put into a treatment center that did not use big books. You know, they did not talk about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They did not talk about hope. They talked about triggers and issues and personal things. And the only time the big book was opened was in the doctor's meetings. And at those, all he would do is read the stories from the back of the book. So I knew nothing about the first 164 pages, but at that time in my life, I don't think I would have cared anyway, because I was there for the wrong reasons, you could say. But I was the model patient, you know, was voted most likely to stay sober, you know, took notes in the doctor's meetings. I jumped through the hoops and did what I needed to do. And when I got out of treatment, I moved there to Kerrville, because my hostage did too. So I moved to this little podunk town, and I've got a trash bag full of clothes to my name. That is literally all I had at 25 to show for my existence. The disease had pretty much taken everything else. And I moved there, and I work no steps. I don't get a sponsor. I didn't go to meetings. That's not true. I went to the men's halfway house meetings. They were very good meetings, but they also had men there. And so those are the only meetings I would go to. And within a month, I'm crawling out of my skin. I can't figure out why either, because I've been dry now for 60 days. I thought life was going to get better. I put down alcohol. I'm moving. Things should go better. But I finally now understand that alcohol had nothing to do with what my problem was. It was this void inside, you know? And so it's 60 days dry, living in this women's halfway house kind of deal. I am irritable, restless, discontent. I'm crawling out of my skin. And the only thing I know that makes this go away is to drink. So I remember looking in the mirror and going, all right, girl, you can drink. Just don't do drugs. Drugs were the problem. You know, cocaine, that was the problem. But you can drink. I have scars on my face from what alcohol did at 17. And yet that didn't even cross my mind. You know, cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, it forgot to remind me about those deals. And the book says I couldn't even remember all of that pain anyway. I don't have that power. So I drank that night, and that began another pretty much year binge that I went out on. And it's so true that it gets worse, never better, because that's exactly what happened. Little problem we had, though, this time was that they'd hired me at that treatment center. Oops. Because I was going to say, you know, I was going to do so well that they had confidence in me and they hired me there. So I'm leading a bit of a double life, you could say, because I'm working at this treatment center and then, you know, obsessing about getting off work and getting that first beer right after work. And I'm doing all my crazy stuff at night, sometimes not sleeping, and then coming back right into work to the treatment center the next day. And it was insane. And I'm a good actress, you know, I thought I'd pulled it off well. I find out later that they knew, you know, apparently when your car breaks down more times than, you know, your car breaks down, you get advances on your paycheck, you know, your grandmother keeps dying, all these excuses I kept coming up with. Plus, I'd just gone to treatment there a month before. So they kind of had an idea, but I thought I was covering it up well. And you know, it was insane. I would drive to San Antonio, which is about an hour away, to go out, to go dancing, you know, and I was, Bill talks about being the lone wolf, you know, and that was me. I would go dancing by myself all the time. It was really cool. And it's kind of funny because I couldn't tell the truth to save my life, you know, in my disease. And the joke is that my name means truthful one. I think my parents really screwed me at birth there. Right? It's like a little high expectation that I'm going to tell the truth. But I found that I didn't have the power. I could not. And at the end of that last year, it was just every word that came out of my mouth was a lie. I couldn't tell you anything. And when I would go to these clubs and go dancing by myself, people would ask me my name or whatever, and I'd say, Kelly. Don't know why exactly, but she was kind of my alter ego that would go out and get in a lot of trouble. Kelly caused a lot of problems for us. She really did. I don't know. But that was the extent that this disease had me. You know, the honesty that's talked about in this program that is so important. I didn't think I was going to be able to do it because dishonesty had worked for me for so long. You know, it kept me from getting in, you know, consequences. It got me what I wanted. It covered my tracks. It did so much. And so when I finally got to these rooms and they said I'd have to be honest at any cost, it was kind of scary, you know, because Kelly didn't know if she could do that. But thank God she did. anyway, Kelly, big mess. But at the end of that year, I had all the material things back. I had the job, the car, the apartment, the family. I had all the things I'd lost before. I'd gotten them back. But at the end of this 1 3-day binge, I don't know what was different. But let me back up here a minute. Kirsten went back to prison during that year, and I divorced him and met my now husband. I got to quit getting married. This is getting confusing. met my second ex-husband. he was living at that men's halfway house. So see, it paid off to go to those meetings. But he was living there, and he was an alcoholic, and he was in relapse, and so on. And so was I, you know. So it was another healthy beginning to a healthy relationship. And he and I spent 5 months or so together drinking and drugging. And at the end of that time together, it's a 3-day binge, and we're just crying because this has got to stop, you know. So many times we would say that, okay, this is it, you know. And that next Monday I'd come home from work and I'd have a 12-pack of beer with me, and he'd just kind of look at me and it was like, come on. I mean, it's just beer, you know. And I would keep making my excuses that I was not ready. And I don't know why this time was any different. I don't know. I don't know what happened that changed it, but something happened. And just like the gentleman shared earlier, I remember looking up at the ceiling and just going, God, if you were even still there, I need your help. Because I couldn't do this anymore. The internal condition was eating me alive, and the voices in my head were getting way too loud, and the consequences, I just couldn't do it, and yet I didn't know how to stop. And God was not an option that I was hoping to look to. Because I'd been around it my whole life. I'd been raised around church and around religion, and it had been forced down my throat. And I thought that's what getting sober was going to be about. You know, I thought that I'd be going to church constantly, and that I'd be memorizing more scripture and blah, 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 blah. And it was like that. I wore uniforms for 10 years. You know, that should count for something. And catechism, who made you? God made me. What else did God make? Blah, 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 blah. I knew it all. And it hadn't kept me sober, so why would this be any different? So, as I said, that cry out, something changed, though. Something clicked. And somehow I was given the strength to walk into my first meeting that next Monday. That was on a Sunday, and I walked in. And that was January the 11th, 1999. And my life has never been the same. I was so blessed to walk into a meeting where people did carry big books, where people did know their primary purpose, where women came and surrounded me as soon as I walked in. The lady that became my sponsor, she actually walked up to me after I got my desire chip and gave me a card and said, you need a sponsor. I mean, I didn't even have time to waste. It was like she knew what she was there to do. And that began my journey with this miracle that is Alcoholics Anonymous. The woman that stands before you is not at all. It resembles Kelly. Totally different. But what began to happen is she sat me down and pretty much read this book to me. And I had my pen and I had my highlighter, and we would go through, and I was beat into a place where I didn't care what she was going to tell me I needed to do. You know, I joke that had they had me want me to stand on my head and whistle Dixie 2 hours every day, if that's what they said was going to work to get sober at that time, I would have done it because I didn't care. I wanted to do anything not to be Kelly anymore. You know, and the book talks about being beat into that state of reasonableness. And I would have thought that that happened to me at 25 when I lost everything. But that's not the case, because reasonableness takes place up here. It's ready to throw out all the old ideas. It's ready to lay aside the prejudice. It's ready to do whatever I've got to do to change. And I was tired of being me. And so the things that she was suggesting that I do, which came straight out of this book, were absolutely inviting to me. Because what I got to see in her is the first time she shared with me some of her story. You know, the first time she explained to me what had happened to her through working these steps, it was the phrase that you hear so much, I want what you have. You know, this woman was free and had been for 12 or 13 years, and I didn't know how she did it, and I didn't understand how it was going to work, but I didn't care, you know. These steps are an amazing thing. You know, and Bill's story talks about that common sense would thus become uncommon sense. And that's exactly what's happened, you know, through working these steps. All these things that used to be me, all these things that used to be my immediate reaction and how I used to deal with life, they've somehow gone out the window. And this whole new set of ideals, as the book said, has come in. And the biggest thing, obviously, for so many of us is becoming recovered. You know, the obsession to drink, lifted, gone. Position of neutrality, safe and protected. You know, the 10-step promises that were in here. Because I imagined that getting sober would be hiding from alcohol, you know, not going out, not having fun anymore, not watching commercials about, you know, alcohol. You know, I could not imagine how this was going to work. But they promised me that it was just going to be gone. And I don't know about you, but from 14 to 26, I either had alcohol in my body or I thought about getting alcohol in my body. And so the thought that was going to be gone, it didn't make any sense. But that absolutely happened, and it happened as soon as I began doing these steps and doing this deal. You know, as I did my first, you know, fourth and fifth step and you know, all this stuff, all the shame and the guilt that came with my disease, and it was gone. You know, all the victim role that I was so good at. You know, I'm the queen. Well, that's what she told me. She said I was the queen victim, because everything that happened in my life, I would blame on everybody else. You know, and especially my first marriage, all the terrible things that happened there. It was like if you wanted to talk about it, I would just vomit it on you. I would tell you these terrible things that he did. You know, and I got tired of hearing myself talk about it. You know. But it was what I could blame so much on. He's the one that introduced me to drugs. He's the one that drank so much. He, you know. And so as I began to do this work, and I got to see that I couldn't do that anymore. And that was scary, because if I stay a victim, that's pretty cool. You know, I don't have to accept responsibility for my life sucks. I can blame it on you. I don't have to grow up. I don't have to look at myself, and it was comfortable and it was familiar. Car accident. I used to use my car accident as a victim deal. You know, Scott, let me tell you what happened. You know, I would neglect to tell him. I mean, I would tell him I wouldn't. Here's some truth. I used to tell people I fell asleep and hit a telephone pole. Oh, I forgot about that. See, we had a very strong Christian family, and so that's what they told everyone. We wanted to save face, you know, for the family, and I've just blamed it on them. Do you see how I just did that? They started the lie. I just had to keep it up. But they did. They used it. That's kind of how the deal went, and I bought the story, and that's what I would tell people. And I remember I'd go to bars, and I would, because in the wreck, I bit off my bottom lip, and this long story how I got this one, but I bit my first one off. And so when I would go to bars and I would drink, if I would spill, you know, people go, what, you got a hole in your lip? And I'd go, no, actually, I was in an accident, you know. And I would tell them the story and they'd feel sorry for me and I'd get something out of it. And that's the kind of stuff that I lived in for so long, this victim stuff, the abuse, the blah, blah, blah. And so in 4 and 5, you know, I really had to look at what the truth was and I had to make a decision. Was I tired of being a victim? Was I tired of letting these things run my life? You know, and it, at 26 years old, the victim role, it just wasn't comfortable anymore because alcohol comes with the victim role. Because my experience was that victims don't get sober. And after being a victim to my past for so long, I was ready to do something different. And what a freedom there was in that. Because I couldn't do anything about my past. I couldn't do anything about the marriages and the idiots I had picked to be in relationships with. You know, I couldn't do anything about that. But what I could do something about was me and freedom. You know, this... This book talks about that we've got two choices. We're either going to die the alcoholic death or we're going to live on a spiritual basis. And forever I had been looking for option C, you know, because they pretty much narrowed it down to two. And I was like, God, what about, you know? And after all of these option C's failing, I finally realized that it really does come down to that. I'm either going to seek spiritual help or not. And if I choose or not, then I know exactly what's going to happen. You know, I'm going to place myself in a position that I've been before, and I don't want to be there. And so everything I'm doing in this program is to help me seek spiritual help, is to help me go forward towards the light, you know, because we are. We're either going one way or the other. And at almost 7 years sober, I have definitely found that it's pretty painful to not seek that light and to not go that direction. I've gotten complacent in my sobriety. I've done some stupid things in my sobriety, but by the grace of God, I get to recognize my mistakes, look at my behavior, go clean it up, and try to do something different next time. And what a gift, because last time all I would do was blame it on you, you know, and go on down the road. But today it gives me tools on how to keep seeking that light. And by doing that, for almost 7 years, the obsession to drink has never returned. And I'm pretty clear that if I keep doing this, if I keep doing these simple set of rules that they've given me, that my life's going to keep going that way. By the time I got to, I think I had about 2 months sober, and I'd been through the work, the obsession had been lifted, and my I'll just call him Shane. There we go. That's easier in deciding which ex he is. But my second husband, he relapsed, and I was devastated, you know, because I thought we were going to be sober forever together and sober conferences and sober couple. And he really screwed that up because he relapsed. But I began to really understand what it meant to rely on the women that were in this fellowship. Because see, when I got here, I wanted nothing to do with women. I didn't want to be around them because they were competition. They wanted something. I didn't have a lot of women friends. It was mostly men. And so when Shane was kind of taken out of the picture for a while, it was like I was surrounded by the women in this fellowship. And again, it was because they knew exactly what their primary purpose was. You know, they knew that they needed to carry this message and to help me. And that was one of the first times in early recovery that I really began to understand that this power I'd connected to was real and it was tangible and that I was really free. Because I wanted the pain that came with that situation, you know, I knew if I would drink, that pain would go away, at least temporarily, you know. And I was terrified because I had never not drinking before, you know. And I remember crying so hard that night that I just fell on the ground exhausted because I knew if I walked out the door, I'd get loaded because that's what Alicia does, you know. But just like the book says, I was safe and protected. And I crawled into bed and all I could say was help, you know, fell asleep, woke up the next morning and it was like, oh my God, I didn't drink. And that was the first hand of God that I felt, just him saying, I've got you. You know, this is nothing. You just hang on and see what I've got for you and you're going to get blown away. And I'm so grateful that happened because it really helped me step out a little bit more on faith that this deal was real, that it was going to work. And the women that had surrounded me and the people that had helped me. And it's never failed me, You know, it's always been there. And, you know, this God stuff was like I said, it was something I didn't really want to have to turn to, because the God in our household, it wasn't real warm and fuzzy. You know, there was more of the punishing and the different stuff like that. And the expectations and the rules were set so high, and I couldn't live up to them. So it was like, screw it, you know, and then I'd have more guilt. And it was just a continuous cycle. And, you know, at 14, my dad took away my Go-Go's and Cyndi Lauper tapes and burned them because they were satanic. Okay, we got the beat, you know. So if God hates the Go-Go's, I'm screwed, because I'm already, you know, Kelly's already starting, and Kelly does a little more than just sing. So this is the kind of, you know, and that was at 14. So by the time I'm 26, my conception of God was very warped. It was very off. And so this loving and forgiving and caring and strong and grace and mercy, all these things that I know today were not in my conception. And it came from being willing to throw out, to lay aside prejudice that I had against spiritual things, to lay them aside so that I could have a new experience. The God I know today was with me in that car that night when I got in my wreck. He has been with me in the many times when I've done things that I'm not proud of. He's been with me every time I've cried and looked at myself in the mirror and said, this has got to stop. He was with me through each one of those times. And my experience was that when I finally did cry out, he was right there. You know, he didn't say, that's it, you went too far this time. Or you cried out last week and I said I'd help and you didn't listen. Not at all. He was right there. And I joke that he was kind of on walkie-talkie, and he was like, she finally said it. Get her, you know. She means it this time. Because as I said, I was picked up and taken to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that next night, you know. And the love that I felt in that room and the acceptance, you know. I was shown unconditional love by my sponsor, and I in turn get to show it to the women that I get to work with. And what a gift that was. This primary purpose piece, as far as carrying this message, has been probably the main thing, which the book says it's going to, but it's probably been the main thing that has kept me sober. Because as I said, I have not done everything right in my sobriety. I have not done everything perfect, and I've screwed up a lot. But the one thing that I have continued to do is to carry this message. And whether it be in Podunk, Kerrville, Texas, you know, or actually Ingram, Texas, even more Podunk. But whether it be there to a newcomer that walks in there, or places I get to speak, it's like God keeps putting women in front of me that need help. And as I look in their eyes, and they can't even look at me, they're looking down at the ground and they're so full of shame, I know why. Because I've been there. I know what they've been through. I know what they're feeling. I know the hopelessness that they have. And I have a solution. What an amazing deal. No one wanted anything from me before. Well, not anything good, you know, dope or whatever. But today, what a gift to actually have something. The book says we're going to be able to, you know, we've recovered and been given the power to save others. What an amazing deal. And so I can sit down with the women that God places in front of me, and I can start them at the title page and begin them on this journey just like it was done with me. I remember one of the first girls that I sponsored, she got loaded. She got drunk, and I called my sponsor and I said, I killed her. I didn't know. I didn't really understand. You just carry the message and see what happens. I really thought I'd screwed her up and done it wrong. But the cool thing was is that this girl came in and out of this deal and would even come to meetings drunk. You know, you because she wanted so badly to be sober, but just wasn't at her end yet. She just wasn't ready. And I would work with her, and she'd go back out, and it was just a cycle that she kept going through. And I remember one day I finally told her, I said, hon, I'm going to love you drunk. I'm going to love you sober. But call me when you're ready. And being a woman, that was hard to do because I get emotionally attached, and I wanted to fix her and save her and do all this, but I let go. And what happened from that was one day I finally got the call that she was ready, and she was checking herself into a state-funded treatment center, and I was able to go out there with her and begin the steps with her. And she's one of my best friends in the world today and has about 5 years sober, and she's the godmother of my son. And it's a pretty cool deal, because the bond that was created there will never be broken. You know, the gift that God had given me so many years ago, I was able to pass on to her, and to look at her today and see who she is a pretty amazing deal. And that's what I'm here for. You know, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And if I'm not doing it, then what was all that for? You know, if I'm not carrying this message to the next woman, that means that all this stuff that I've been through is just null and void. It has no hope, but it's going to be used to help other people. What you guys are doing here in this country, and the ones that have come from so far away, the horror stories that I'm hearing about you guys getting ridiculed for carrying this message the way it's supposed to be carried, and that I realized just how blessed I was to walk into a group that was carrying big books, and Chris and Myers and their experience. I mean, it's just everywhere. And I cannot imagine what might have happened to me had I walked into a room where that was happening, where no one talked to me, where no one talked about God, where no one carried a big book. I probably would have walked away and said, I'm not going back there again. So what you guys are doing is changing the world. I mean, it really is, on a huge scale, with so many of you from so many different places. You're changing the world. And I want to commend each of you who's standing up, you know, for this message and what's in this book, because it's given life to me and to so many others, and we need it. And I just encourage you that you just keep doing it, because obviously they had a vision here in London to come bring this to London, and it just worked here. And hopefully what this weekend will do will pump people up to get out there and go carry it even more, you know, really piss them off now. I feel sorry for the people in those half-assed, oops, sorry, middle-of-the-road meetings now. I'm like, where'd these guys come from? I shared last year, when I had the honor to go to Denmark and speak, I had married alcoholic number two, and that's in the book. Anyway, I had married Shane, god dang, and unfortunately, he struggled staying sober and continued to struggle staying sober. And I find out that I struggle a bit with codependency, apparently, because I thought I was going to fix him. I thought I could save him. I thought I could love him into recovery. I thought I could do this or do that. And it didn't work. And a couple of years ago, it almost took my sobriety, because I am so disconnected from God, because I'm focused on him and where he is and what he's doing and what meeting he's going to and where's the checkbook and does he love me and blah, blah, blah. And I'm so focused on him that I'm not focused on God. And I've heard it said before, and it is my experience, anything I put before God in this program, anything that I focus on more than that, it's going to get me into a bad spot. And it absolutely did. And I ended up entering the rooms of Al-Anon and had to just kind of regroup and let him go in the best ways that I possibly could. And last year he ended up going to treatment again, and we have a little boy. His name's Ethan. Anyone wants to come find Sam? His name's Ethan, and what a gift he's been. I mean, I always wanted to be a mother. You know, and in my disease, when I was married to my first husband, I was a stepmother, and I wasn't a very good one. You know, I was either loaded all the time, or I was thinking about getting loaded all the time, so I could not even be there for these children that I love so much. I didn't have the power to be a stepmother in my disease, and so when I got sober, that's always been. I want to be a mother, and at about a year sober, I found out I was pregnant, and was not quite the timing I was looking for. but God knew exactly what he was doing, you know, and Ethan is, he's just a huge gift in my life today. And the cool thing is, the amazing thing is he will never have to see me loaded, ever. If I keep seeking this light and do what I've been doing up until this point, this child will never have to go through any of that. there will be a safe place for him to be, you know, and that's a gift from this program. But last year, I had to make a decision to divorce and to go ahead and remove myself from that situation. And it was pretty much one of the hardest things I've ever done because it was very scary. Because I didn't know what it was going to look like to be, you know, single, to be, you know, financially, all these different fears that I had about doing this. And yet I had a lot of experience to draw on to see that God had taken care of me in the past, that Ethan and I had never gone without, that that if I keep showing up and doing what I need to do, which is help carry this message, God continues to take care of me. And made that decision. And this last year, it was finalized in January, and this year's been a trip. it's been something else. But what I've seen is that the more I seek this power, the more I work these steps, the more I carry this message, the more I try to help other women, the more everything just seems to work out, you know. And the book says, in trials and low spots, helping others saves the day. And I can't tell you how many times in this last year I've been sitting at home feeling sorry for myself. I do that very well. I'm feeling sorry for myself, and I'm in the house that I bought last May, and I've got food in the refrigerator, and my healthy son is asleep in the bedroom, and the car that runs with gas in it is in the driveway, and I am sitting at home just so, you know, pathetic. And the phone will ring, and then I can see on the caller ID it's one of my sponsees. And it's drama mama, you know, it's like, it's the one that, and I look at it and it's just like, oh God, no, not now, you know, I'm just being honest here. Cause I'm thinking about me right now, for goodness sakes. The last thing I want to do is think about her. And, I have a choice to make. This is the one choice I do have. I'm either going to seek spiritual help or not. And one of the ways I can seek spiritual help is by helping other people. So literally with a push of a button, I'm going to change my life. I'm either going to let the phone go and not answer it, cause I'm thinking about me and I'm busy right now, or I'm going to answer that phone. And by the grace of God, he's given me the power to press the button. And I answer that phone, and guys, by the time I get off, I'm not thinking about me anymore. Because she's living in a halfway house with 14 other insane women. She's got about a week sober. She has no rights to her children. She has no money, no skills, no nothing, but wants to be sober more than anything else in the world and is so hopeless. And it's been proven to me over and over again, if I will take the time to get out of myself and think about somebody else, then they're going to think about God, and God's going to take care of me. And I'm going to think about them, and they're going to think about God, and God's going to take care of me. And it's how it works over and over. I am blessed beyond belief to have the women in my life that I do that need help, that need me. And it's like right when stuff's going on, it seems like another one will show up. It's like God knows exactly what I need. He's like, whoop, she's going to have a lot of stuff to think about. Let's give her another sick one, you know, let's throw someone else in there. But it's a joy. It's a gift. There's nothing like it. And that's the reason they're having this conference, you know, because it is such an amazing thing. And I remember the first time I heard helping others is better than any high I've ever had. It was like, buddy, I've been high a lot. And that's saying something. But it's so true. The first time you see that person pick up, you know, the 30 days, the 60 days, and their lives start to come back together, and the promises that are starting to come true, and they're crying, and then they begin helping others. The first time that happened, I'm sitting in a meeting with my sponsor, then there's me, then there's a girl that I sponsor and a girl that she sponsors sitting there, and that's a pretty breathtaking deal. That's four miracles sitting in a row, and that last one's ready to look for somebody else, is hungry to go carry the message. And that's what's happening here. This torch is being passed from one of you to the next. And if I don't go out and carry this, if I'm not in that meeting when that new woman walks in, then shame on me. Because what if I was the only woman in that room? Because I don't know about y'all. There's a lot of women here tonight. But for some reason, we're struggling with getting women to stay sober. You know, or I don't know what the excuses are or what they're using. But it's like there's a handful, you know. And what if I'm not in that room when she walks in, just like I had that day, you know? And if I'm not, then I've missed my opportunity, and I've got to keep doing this. I'm going to end here with something I usually end with. Somebody's laughing back there. A couple years ago, I gave my father a CD of a talk that I'd done at a women's conference, and I didn't know exactly what he was going to think, and you know, Dad and I hadn't had a very good relationship because at 14, my parents divorced, and he left, and he was a missionary and a pastor and all this, and he was Mr. Christian out there saving souls for Jesus, you know, and I was satanic possessed girl, so we didn't hang out a lot. You know, Kelly and him didn't really get close, and so here I am at 26 or 27 at the time, I think, and I'm giving my dad this CD, and when he gave it back to me after listening to it, he's just crying because of what his little girl is doing today. And the little girl he almost watched die at 17 is now doing this, you know, because had you told me years ago that I'd be talking to people about God and staying sober, I'd be like, I'm much too cool for that. You know, I would have thought that was an insult instead of something cool. But my dad gave me the CD back and he said, Alicia, I really think you need to write some songs about what you've been through in your past. I'll put them to music and we'll get them recorded. Because my dad's ministry is music, and so he thought this was a great idea. And I was like, Dad, I've never written anything. I don't sing. We have musical talent in our family, but I sing in the shower and in the car. You know, that's about it. And I have no money. So I figured for sure, why even try? But I decided one night just to sit down and just mess with it and just see what happened. And I ended up writing a poem, because I don't know how to write songs, and any of you musicians in the room would have laughed at me because I'm sitting at the computer going, I have a thesaurus and a rhyming dictionary next to me. Very, very off-the-cuff writing. I'm looking up all these words. But I'm sitting there going, da 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 da, and then typing it out. You know, I had no idea what I was doing. But anyway, the poem gets finished, and it's entitled Scars. For me, external scars, almost like battle wounds from my disease, and some of you have them. But more importantly than that, the internal scars, the internal wounds, the memories, the pain, the things that we have inside, memories of things that only we know about, you know. And in this poem it says, I ask God why all these things took place, things that changed me forever and caused such disgrace. His answer came clear. The tears began to lift. My child, those scars are your greatest gift. With my power behind you, we will change lives together. Trust me, keep seeking, and I'll leave you never. And that was so true for me. Everything I've been through, everything you've been through, from that first drink to the breath you're drawing now, is going to be used. These scars are our greatest gift, you know? If I'm not using them to bring hope to the newcomer, if I'm not using it so that a woman can identify with me and then to give her the rest of the hope in this book, then it's just my victim trump cards. It's just the cross I bear, you know? But no, these all have a purpose. And page 124... one of my favorite paragraphs in here, it says, this painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were giving hope, how we were given help, is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Here it is. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. And that's what this is about, to carry this message, to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety, to help them avert death and misery. That's pretty huge. I'm honored to be a part of this. I'm honored to be here this evening. Thank you again to all of you who asked me to come speak. I'm going to end with singing the chorus. This is a bit strange, and I battled whether to do this or not. Okay. First, I get my gum out. I'm very professional here. Got to figure out a better way to do this. Okay. So now with God's power, all the scars make sense. My spirit protected, I have found my defense. There is hope for you, 'cause there was hope for me, and he'll walk you through it. Believe that you're set free from the battle deep inside, and it's more than you can bear, and you're crying out for comfort, finding nothing there. There is hope for you, 'cause there was hope for me, and he'll walk you through it. Believe, oh, 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 you can be free. Thank you.
Thanks, Alicia. We would now like to observe tradition 7 with self-supporting from our own contributions. There are some pots which are going to get passed up and down the rows. If you could give generously. Thank you. Great.